This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. President Joe Biden appealed to Russian President Vladimir Putin to step back from the edge of war with Ukraine on Tuesday, speaking starkly of the, quote, needless death and destruction Moscow could cause and international outrage Putin would face. In an address to the U.S. people, Biden said the United States estimates that 150,000 Russian troops now encircle Ukraine, adding that while reports that some forces had withdrawn were welcome, they were unverified and an invasion remained very much a possibility. Biden said diplomacy remains a welcome off-ramp. If Russia invades Ukraine, the United States and its allies are prepared to respond with penalties aimed at exacting economic pain and global isolation, he said. Much of Biden's remarks were aimed squarely at Putin, who has demanded that NATO not accept Ukraine as a member and stop any further eastward expansion. Quote, the United States and NATO are not a threat to Russia. Ukraine is not threatening Russia. Neither the U.S. nor NATO have missiles in Ukraine. We do not have plans to put them there as well. We are not targeting the people of Russia. We do not seek to destabilize Russia, said Biden. The American president also appealed directly to Russian citizens. Quote, to the citizens of Russia, you are not our enemy, and I don't believe you want a bloody, destructive war against Ukraine, Biden said. Biden said the United States is, quote, not seeking direct confrontation with Russia and that American soldiers were not going to fight in Ukraine. But he said if Russia were to attack Americans in Ukraine, quote, we will respond forcefully. This is VOA News. Ottawa's police chief resigned on Tuesday after criticism he did not do enough to stop COVID-19 protests that have paralyzed Canada's capital city and forced Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to invoke emergency powers. A trucker-led movement calling on the government to lift vaccine mandates has occupied parts of downtown Ottawa since late January and blocked U.S. border crossings, inspiring similar protests around the world even as Canada moves to lift some health restrictions. Protesters retreated from the Ambassador Bridge to the U.S. city of Detroit and two other crossings after threats of fines and jail time, but hundreds of trucks are still blocking downtown areas, raising questions over Ottawa's police chief handling of the crisis. Critics alleged he was too permissive towards protesters who at the peak of their movement had parked 4,000 trucks and vehicles near Canada's parliament, prime minister's office, and other government buildings. Ethiopia's parliament on Tuesday voted for an early end to a six-month state of emergency, effective immediately, adding to signs that a bloody conflict between the government and Tigrayan forces could be easing. The war in Africa's second-largest nation has largely grounded to a stalemate, and diplomats helping to mediate between the two sides are cautiously optimistic that progress towards peace is being made. The state of emergency gave the government power to detain citizens without charge and search homes without a warrant. Thousands of Tigrayan civilians were rounded up and held in prisons and warehouses. Ethiopia imposed the order in November after Tigrayan forces invade two other regions threatening the capital. But a government offensive in December pushed the Tigrayans back, although fighting continues in the region of Afar and in Tigray, where millions depend on food aid, remains cut off with no food arriving since mid-December. Britain's Prince Andrew has settled a U.S. lawsuit by Virginia Giuffre, accusing him of sexually abusing her when she was a teenager. The settlement, which includes an undisclosed payment, was revealed on Tuesday in a filing in Manhattan federal court where Giuffre had sued the Duke of York last August. The prince did not admit wrongdoing in the settlement. Giuffre's case had focused on Andrew's friendship with the late Jeffrey Epstein, the financier and sex offender who she said also sexually abused her. The filing said Andrew regrets his past association with Epstein. Find more on our website, voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, February 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Duapo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. and its allies said there are no signs of Russia troops pulling back from Ukraine border,
leading some to hope the drums of war might be fading. But NATO said it had yet to see any evidence of a de-escalation that could avert a military conflict.
The UN warns years of climate-related disasters have created an environment where deadly diseases are flourishing in Somalia.
Somalia is facing a food, malnutrition, and water crisis after 3 years of consecutive drought compounded by heavy flooding and an infestation of desert locusts.
And Israel's prime minister says Israel and its Arab allies are forging a regional, quote, ring of stability, unquote. We have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russia says some of its troops are returning to base after exercises near Ukraine, but NATO and the United States say they had yet to see any evidence of de-escalation that could avert war. This report is produced by Zachary Gorman of Reuters.
The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday released video of what it said were some of its troops returning to base after exercises near Ukraine, leading some to hope the drums of war might be fading. But NATO said it had yet to see any evidence of a de-escalation that could avert a military conflict. Russia did not say how many units were pulling back. Its deployment of some 130,000 troops to the north, east, and south of Ukraine triggered alarms in Western capitals that a military operation could be imminent. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin Tuesday and said the withdrawal of some Russian troops was a good sign.
Courageous and responsible action is now required of everybody. One thing I want to say, for my generation, war in Europe has become unthinkable, and we must ensure it stays that way.
Putin again denied his country sought conflict.
Do we want it or not? Of course not. This is why we have offered our proposals to start the negotiation process, which should lead to an agreement of providing equal security for everybody, including our country.
But many remained skeptical. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters he wanted to see stronger signals of rapprochement.
There are signs from Moscow that diplomacy should continue. This gives grounds for cautious optimism. But so far, we have not seen any sign of de-escalation on the ground.
New footage on Tuesday showed continued Russian military drills, this time artillery firing in Crimea, a region seized from Ukraine in 2014. Russia's show of force near Ukraine's borders has prompted months of frantic Western diplomacy and drawn threats of severe sanctions if it invades, culminating in a crescendo of U.S. and British warnings in recent days that this could happen at any time.
Diplomacy has reached a fever pitch between NATO allies and President Vladimir Putin, with the White House offering the Russian leader two choices: an invasion of Ukraine with devastating consequences, or a negotiated peace with what Putin sees as humiliating concessions. What's his next move? Anita Powell reports.
The White House insists there is only one way out of the mounting crisis as Russia continues to amass troops and hold drills along the Ukrainian border: diplomacy. But after a frenzied weekend of high-level talks between President Joe Biden and the leaders of Russia and Ukraine, an unsettling fact remains. No one knows what President Vladimir Putin's next move will be. White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
As we have said before, we're in the window when an invasion could begin at any time. We will not comment on any details of our intelligence information, except to say that it could begin this week. The U.S. is ready for any situation.
Ukraine's leader on Monday said all signs point to an invasion. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
We are told that February 16 will be the day of the invasion. We'll make it a day of national unity. The relevant decree has been signed. We will put out national flags, put on yellow-blue ribbons, and will show our unity to the entire world.
Washington has sent hundreds of millions in military aid to Ukraine and on Monday ordered the temporary relocation of the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. Will Pomerantz, acting director of the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, told VOA that Putin is unlikely to back down. Putin has demanded that Ukraine be barred from its goal of joining the NATO alliance. The U.S. has dismissed that demand, citing NATO's open-door policy.
I don't see Putin really having an option to retreat because he has put so much at stake during this crisis. And to retreat and kind of say, never mind, that's not Vladimir Putin's strategies.
On Monday, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz visited Kyiv ahead of a Tuesday trip to Moscow and demanded clear steps to de-escalate the current tensions.
We are prepared to have a serious dialogue with Russia about questions of European security. NATO and the USA made proposals to Russia that we support. We now expect a reaction and answer from Russia.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told Putin that Russia should stay in the talks.
The readiness for listening to counter-arguments, our possibilities aren't exhausted. Of course, they shouldn't continue endlessly, but at this stage, I would propose to continue and increase them.
Biden says NATO allies are in lockstep and that Russia will face harsh sanctions if it invades. It is clear there is no love lost between the formerly United Soviet states. Russia annexed part of Ukraine in 2014 and controls it still. But in the testy, frigid Ukrainian capital, residents this Valentine's Day are trying to banish fear with the one force stronger than war. Love. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Tensions between Russia and Ukraine have mobilized the most radical sectors of Ukrainian nationalism. From Kyiv, Ricardo Marquina has this report, narrated by John Spear.
With tensions over a possible war with Russia at an all-time high, Ukrainian civilians receive military training every weekend. In an abandoned former Soviet military facility in the suburbs of Kyiv, men and women learn how to use firearms and what to do in an urban conflict. Ivan, who declined to give his surname, is a war veteran who is serving as a drill instructor in this exercise. We are calm. If necessary, we will return to defend our country. We work on it, see? It's the weekend and we've come to train. The training is not organized by the Ukrainian armed forces, but by one of the most active battalions during the war in the east of the country, the Azov Battalion, often criticized for holding far-right and even neo-Nazi positions. Now, this organization has stepped into politics by creating the National Core Party. Its leaders refuse to be classified as ultra-nationalists or extremists and define themselves as patriots in times of war. Maxim Zorin is one of the party's leaders. We position ourselves as Ukrainian nationalists, but we have to understand that the nationalist right in Ukraine is very different from that of Europe or the US. We have other priorities. We face other problems. The biggest of those priorities that we need to resolve is the war with the Russian Federation. For Ukraine's sizable Jewish minority, largely concentrated in the eastern city of Dnepr, worries about the growth of the far right were highest during the 2013 so-called Maidan protests. But when stability returned, and with a new leadership in power, concerns about nationalist extremism abated. Zelig Brez is director of the Dnepropetrovsk Jewish community, and he says that while these fringe groups do exist, radicals make up only a small part of Ukrainian society.
We believe that it's not a major mainstream part of the political environment, and the common sense and the people with the very good feelings and support and friendship and tolerance is very strong in Ukraine. So these groups exist, but they comprise a very minor percentage of the society.
Russian propaganda has portrayed these far-right groups as a fundamental part of Ukraine's politics. But a coalition, all the far-right parties failed to make it into the Ukrainian parliament in the last legislative elections. Kira Rudik heads the Liberal Holos, or Voice, party.
The amount of people who are supporting really far-right movements is fairly small. So there is no far-right party in the Ukrainian parliament, and the latest polls are showing that people are not giving them enough support. So what we are seeing is just created by the society, limited group of people who are far right, which I believe would happen in any democratic country.
The possibility of a large-scale armed conflict persists, and some fear this can give wings to Ukrainian nationalism, including its most radical sectors. For Ricardo Marquina in Kiev, John Speer, VOA News.
With the German Chancellor in Moscow meeting with the Russian President to try and find a diplomatic solution to the tension between Russia, Ukraine and the West, how has the situation affected the region's geopolitics? Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller speaks with Andrew Lawson, a fellow in the European, Russian and Eurasian program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Well, I think right now we're looking at the possibility of entering a time of deep uncertainty. Right now what Russia's looking to do is to fundamentally rewrite the rules of post-war order in Europe. And so what that means is if we can't count on Russia to respect the sovereignty of state, to the peaceful resolution of dispute and the right of Ukraine to determine its own policy path, then we run the risk of increased conflict in the region. Certainly there would have to be a NATO response to any Russian attack, which would potentially lead us to a spiral of escalation. Russia has said repeatedly it views NATO as a malign power intent on restricting Russia's rise. So I think the implications of this conflict, should things get any worse on the border with Russia and Ukraine, are quite severe and is really leading us into some frightening unknowns.
Andrew, those are some of the short-term implications, but as someone who looks at this, what do you see as some of the longer-term implications?
Well, I think one of the big questions, of course, is will Russia succeed at changing Ukraine's policy path? Will Russia decide to send in forces to occupy Ukraine? And then what will the Ukrainian state look like as a result? Another question that this question raises is what happens in terms of NATO force posture in its eastern flank? Certainly, the easternmost members of NATO are looking for reassurance that it can count on support from other allies in case Russia pushes forward with even more irredentist claims. So that's also something to watch out for. And then the question finally is, what happens with Belarus? Belarus right now is being used essentially as a staging ground for a potential attack on Ukraine. If it gets drawn into this conflict, then Belarus would move much more deeply into alignment with Russia and would kind of expand this from a bilateral conflict to very much a regional one, where Poland, Lithuania, other countries that are bordering Belarus are going to be very concerned about what that means for their own security.
That's Flashpoints Ukraine's Steve Miller speaking with Andrew Lawson, a fellow in the Europe, Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In other news, Israel's prime minister says Israel and its Arab allies are forging a regional, quote, ring of stability, unquote. He spoke Tuesday as he wrapped up a lightning trip to the Gulf state of Bahrain that aimed to send a clear message of unity against shared regional rival Iran. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett made the first official visit by an Israeli leader to Bahrain since the countries established formal diplomatic relations in 2020 as part of the U.S. brokered, quote, Abraham Accords, unquote. In recent months, the countries have stepped up their ties in the face of rising tensions with Iran. Bennett also met with leaders of the U.S.'s 5th Fleet, which is headquartered in Bahrain. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Libya has been thrown into further political chaos and confusion. This after the country's eastern-based parliament elected Fathi Bashagha as the new prime minister just hours after Abdul Hamid Dbeibeh, the current prime minister, refused to be replaced. The election of Bashagha by the eastern Libya-based House of Representatives is seen by some analysts as a major setback for the country, which has tried for years to unify itself, but now is again suddenly divided, with its leadership contested. Reporter Angie Omar discussed the Libyan political crisis with Jason Pack, author of Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder, and the president of the consultancy organization Libya Analysis.
It would be dark days indeed if we return to the situation whereby Libya has two prime ministers and two rival governments, as prevailed between 2014 and the election of the GNU in 2020. I think that this situation is actually likely to be resolved, and I don't believe that there will be a civil war. It's quite interesting the extent to which key supporters in Dbeibeh's camp have all of a sudden flocked to supporting Bashagha. such as some of the Misratin militias and some of the important Tripoli-based groups. We are in a wait-and-see situation, but what is transpiring is an example of the global enduring disorder that we're all living through.
The United Nations announced in a press conference through Stephanie Dujarric, the official spokesman for the Secretary General, the continuation of its recognition of the unity government headed by Abdelhamid Dbeibah as the government tasked with leading the country to the elections. How significant is such a statement from the UN?
Well, actually, the UN's position is more nuanced than that. Stéphane Dujarric and the special advisor, Stephanie Williams, have hedged their bets. Stephanie has met with both Dbeibah and Bashagha over the last days, and she has acknowledged Bashagha as prime minister designate. And it seems that the US, UN, and UK are actually willing to work with Bashagha by saying, well, it's up to the Libyans. The only thing that we demand as the international community who initiated the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum process is that elections happen. But if the House of Representatives works with the higher state council and replaces the prime minister, well, then that's a Libyan-led process. That's their line officially. And I think that this shows a kind of simplicity and naivete among the international community, which is they're like, oh, well, we can let the Libyans sort it out. You know, they can get to elections however they want to. And we're not really seeing the UN or US be willing to lead the process in any way.
That's Jason Pack, author of Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder, and the president of the consultancy organization, Libya Analysis. He spoke with reporter Angie Omar. The UN Children's Fund warns that farming is stalking Somalia as years of climate-related disasters have destroyed crops, dried up water sources, and created an environment in which deadly diseases are flourishing. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Somalia is facing a food, malnutrition, and water crisis after 3 years of consecutive drought compounded by heavy flooding and an infestation of desert locusts. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, reports that more than 4 million people, a quarter of the population, need humanitarian food assistance. It says 1.4 million children are acutely malnourished, including 330,000 at risk of dying if they do not receive special treatment for severe acute malnutrition. Additionally, UNICEF's chief of communication in Somalia, Victor Chinyama, says millions of people need emergency water supplies. Speaking from the capital, Mogadishu, he says lack of water is leading to serious outbreaks of diseases such as measles and diarrheal diseases, including cholera. Chinyama says families are taking desperate measures to survive. Since November, he notes 500,000 people have fled their homes in search of food, water, and grazing land for their cattle, exposing them to many risks. He says children on the move are particularly at risk of multiple abuses,
such as sexual violence, exploitation, gender-based violence. And in the context of Somalia, we cannot talk about displacement risks without addressing the specter of children being abducted and recruited by armed groups, for example, such as Al-Shabaab.
UNICEF reports last year, 1,200 children, including girls, were recruited by armed groups and 1,000 children were abducted. Chinyama says many of these children have been victims of multiple violations. He urged the international community to act now to support Somalia and avoid a repeat of the 2011 famine, which killed an estimated quarter million people.
When the international community waits until a famine is declared, as we learned from 2011, that's probably a bit too late. A lot of the mortality happens before the famine is declared. When we start to show pictures of emaciated children, distended pot bellies, I'm afraid that's too late.
UNICEF is appealing for $48 million to carry out its humanitarian operation. It says $7 million is urgently needed by March to purchase high-energy, vitamin-fortified food. It says the lives of 100,000 severely, acutely malnourished children depend upon receiving this treatment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations is urging the international community to maintain its support of the South Pacific island Tonga a month after a devastating volcanic eruption and tsunami. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
On January 15, a massive undersea volcano unleashed tsunami waves that slammed into the Tongan archipelago. Foreign diplomats said that while the loss of life and the number of serious injuries were small, the damage to property was catastrophic. Much of the South Pacific nation has been blanketed with volcanic ash. The United Nations has described the international response to the disaster as fantastic. Aid has been delivered by air and sea by Australia, New Zealand, China, Britain, and the European Union. But it has been a relief operation like no other. Authorities in Tonga demanded that aid shipments be contactless to avoid the spread of the coronavirus in a country that had previously recorded just a single infection last year, with no deaths recorded so far. However, case numbers have now risen and the recovery effort is being hampered by a worrying outbreak of COVID-19. About 141 cases are now confirmed across several villages. The WHO says of January 4 this year, more than 130,000 vaccine doses have been administered. The UN resident coordinator responsible for Tonga, Sanaka Samarasinha, told Radio New Zealand the international aid effort must continue.
We need to strengthen national capacities to respond. We need to pre-position supplies as much as possible, ideally in the Pacific. And we need to make sure that we build stronger networks, more resilient networks of communication, so that we're able to provide some of the technical support that may not be available in each of these small countries virtually at times of such crises.
The World Bank has estimated the damage to buildings, communications and infrastructure was the equivalent of 18% of Tonga's gross domestic product or annual income. However, broader economic losses on farming and tourism aren't reflected in the bank's report. Tonga has a population of just over 100,000. It closed its borders in early 2020 as the coronavirus pandemic swept the globe. Entry to foreign nationals continues to be subject to strict biosecurity conditions. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new global study examines the impact of pharmaceutical substance pollution in the world's rivers. The study, a part of York University's Global Monitoring of Pharmaceuticals project, found potentially toxic levels of medications in the waters of more than a quarter of the 258 rivers studied, located in half the world's countries. Some 127 researchers from 86 scientific institutions around the world participated in the study's investigation. The researchers measured the levels of some 61 pharmaceuticals, including caffeine, carbamazepine, which is used to control seizures, and metformin, a commonly prescribed diabetes medication. The paper suggests pharmaceutical pollution could alter an organism's heart rate, disrupt its reproductive abilities, or change its behavior and physiology. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including Russia announcing some of their troops would return to base after completing recent drills, but stressed that other major military exercises would continue. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba ba boo.